This episode of the Commerce Marketer Podcast is brought to you by Bronto Software, the leading email provider to the global internet retailer 1000. For more ideas on how to improve your marketing automation and to take your email to the next level, visit www.bronto.com/resources. Have you ever bought something on Amazon that had a one-star rating or no ratings at all? Yeah, me neither. Have you ever bought something on Amazon that you liked but didn't review it? Guilty as charged. Whether you already sell on Amazon or are just starting out, you know that customer reviews can be critical to product success. Welcome to the Commerce Marketer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Zakowitz, and today we're going to talk about collecting those ever-elusive Amazon product reviews. Now, join me for the conversation today. Welcome to the show, the CMO of Seller Labs and Amazon extraordinaire, Jeff Cohen. Welcome to the show, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me.
So, Jeff, many people may not know who you are. So before we kind of jump into the topic, I mentioned you're an Amazon extraordinaire here. Why don't you give the audience a little background about yourself and who Seller Labs is?
Yeah, why don't you set a big expectation for me to meet, right?
I like throwing people under the bus here.
Right. So I've been involved in e-commerce since 2005. I started off as a seller on the platform, managing the sale of textbooks for a wholesale company that I worked for, then started in the retail side as the founder and general manager of a website retail textbook store called textbooks.com. And after textbooks.com, I ran a textbook price comparison site called Campus Books, which eventually led me to meeting the founder of Seller Labs. He actually worked for me at Campus Books and then went on to found Seller Labs. We started off as sellers in like 2011, 2012, kind of transitioned over to the software side in 2013. Today, Seller Labs works with thousands of Amazon sellers. Last year, our sellers did over $13 billion on the Amazon platform. We primarily work with sellers on the third-party side, meaning that the sellers are actually representing their own themselves and their own products. We also do work with some sellers on the first party side who are selling their products to Amazon for the product resale.
So books to Amazon, obviously there's some sort of synergy there. Was that helpful for you in understanding selling on Amazon and the inner workings of Amazon, or is that completely coincidental?
So if you speak to anybody in the industry who's been around for 10 plus years and sold on Amazon, they either sold electronics or they sold books. Right? That's what the marketplace was originally intended and created for. It clearly provided an opportunity for us to solve a problem. We were selling books in our own warehouse. We were selling mixed media. If you remember back in the early 2000s, we had to listen to music on CDs. And a lot of that stuff that we would sell would be without the jacket or without the plastic case or the book had a torn cover. And we would sell these books on the marketplace, and then people would give us a bad seller rating saying that our product was not as described, that it had damage. And so what we were trying to do was develop a tool that would allow us to communicate to people who we know bought good quality product from us and ask them to write reviews, seller feedback at the time, on the products that they had bought from us, because that helped us get a better foothill in being able to sell in the marketplace. As the market in 2014, 2015, 2016 started to shift into product and private label and digitally native brands, our tool expanded into not just going for seller feedback, but going for product reviews. So clearly being part of the book business allowed us to be part of the industry at a very early stage. And it's really been the growth of what the marketplace is today. A lot of the things in the marketplace still work based on the original marketplace model from the early 2000s, which is now shifting to a more brand model.
That's a really cool story. And it's amazing. You hear motivational speakers and things like that talk about this, but it's amazing when you look back and you're just kind of in the, you know, they say the right place at the right time, or you're doing something and then, you know, 5 years later, something pivots and you're like, oh yeah, I'm using this piece of education again. That's kind of cool how those things just streamlined along, even though the platform may have shifted and consumers may have shifted. Those things kind of stayed the same and it was able to propel you guys to continue building upon what you did. That's really cool.
Yeah, back in 2005, if you think about where the internet was at that point in time, it was really based on generic search. So where I was going with textbooks.com was definitely more of like where the internet was going back then, because people were going to the internet, they were typing in the search bars, I want tools. So I'm going to type into my search bars, tools.com or tools. Everything was ran by Google search at that point in time, right? And so it's hard to look at the internet 13 years ago and say, I knew where it was going to go. But as a company, as a corporation, as an individual, we take an attitude that's called pivot or persevere, which is that as you hit different milestones in your business, you look at it and you go, is this a point where I need to pivot or a point where I need to persevere? And when you need to pivot, that's when you turn, because you see the market is giving you the signs to say that the pivot is necessary. And when you persevere, it's to say, hey, I'm still on track for where I'm going. And any company that's been around for some length of time, or any entrepreneur who's moved from venture to venture to venture, has had many points of pivot, persevere, failure, and success. And so all of those combine to kind of where the company is today.
That's awesome. Obviously, Jeff, I got you here to talk about gathering product reviews and aggregating these things. And product reviews, whether it's on Amazon or just a website in general, trying to gather something, it's critical for retailers nowadays. And the ones I talk to, they all seem to struggle with it, right? Because they rely on, hey, let's send an email, let's ask them to review a product. And they just kind of leave it at that. Either I get a review or I don't. And when I talk to retailers who sell on Amazon, a lot of it's, well, this general thought of, hey, if I sell a good product and get it to them quickly, I'm going to get a good review. And this goes back to the story you told a minute ago, right? People were selling books or CDs without the cases or something ripped on there, they're getting bad reviews, but how the heck do you get the good reviews? So you had mentioned in presentations you've done, things like that, getting the first 10 reviews is so critical for a seller. Can you explain, Jeff, why that is?
Yeah, so our economy today is an on-demand economy. There's $58 billion spent in the on-demand economy, meaning that when a consumer wants something, they want it, and they want it now. I was actually at Best Buy. Remember Best Buy? They still exist. I was at Best Buy on Saturday looking to pick something up that I needed for my house, and I ran into a friend who was walking out of the store. And I said to him, hey, what were you here looking to buy? And he said, I was trying to buy this one particular cord, and they don't have it. And it's really annoying to me that I can't go to Best Buy and get these. And I said, well, we've created this problem because you know you can go to Amazon and you can buy that cord. And so now his only solution for buying that cord is to shop on Amazon. When he goes to Amazon to buy the cord, he's going to stop and he's going to read the reviews. And so because of the on-demand economy, what's happened within the connection between a buyer and a product is that the unbranded world has been created. And so we used to buy based off of brand and reputation, but in the on-demand economy, we're willing to kind of let brand go to the wayside, but we don't let reputation go to the wayside. And so we look at reviews as a peer mechanism for somebody else to say, hey, I needed this cord. I had the same problem as you, and I was able to solve my problem with the cord that I bought from this website. And then you say, okay, great. I'm going to buy the same cord. So when you look at statistically, Amazon released a stat back in 2016. And the reason I tell people that they need between 5 and 10 reviews, because statistically, once you get over 10 reviews, the increased likelihood of a conversion decreases significantly. So if you have 0 reviews, your ability to get a sale is X. If you have 5 reviews, it's X times 3. If you have 10 reviews, it's X times 10. But if you have 15 reviews, it's still X times 10, right? It doesn't exponentially get better as you go from 10 to 20 to 50 to 100. Now, when you look at your product category, it's still critical for you to understand from a competitive standpoint, if everybody in your category has 200 reviews, you need to get more than 10, but your 10 are the most critical. Those are the ones that when you're trying to run sponsored ads, branded search on Amazon, those are the ones that are going to help you convert, because someone's going to be seeing your ad, they're going to be landing on your product, and they're going to say, does this product meet my needs? I read the reviews. Yes, it does. Okay, great. I'll give it a try.
Let's go with the example of I am a new seller, or I have a brand new product that I have on Amazon. I'm making sales here, but I have zero reviews. What are some of the things that either a new seller or a new seller of a new product can do to start collecting reviews? Because it's getting the first one, I've got to imagine, is probably one of the tougher things. It's, you know, it's the reverse equivalent to me of you go to a restaurant or a bar and you get chicken wings and there's always one chicken wing left on the plate. No one ever wants to eat that last one, right? Getting that first one must be just as difficult because someone's got to be the first.
Yeah.
What are some things that a seller can do to get the first 10, but especially that first one?
Yes. Let's talk about Amazon's rules. Okay. So I think it's important to kind of understand that. Amazon makes it very clear what type of examples you can and cannot do when asking for a review. That includes asking for an unbiased review. That would be using language in your email that says, if this product was good, please leave a review. If this product was not good, please contact customer support. So you can't move unhappy people to a different process. Amazon wants unbiased reviews. You cannot offer any type of money in exchange for a review. You cannot ask a family member to write a review. You cannot offer a refund in exchange for a review. So Amazon is very clear in what you cannot do, right? And a lot of sellers get this confused, but it's very pretty much black and white. You can ask for the review. You need to do it in an unbiased way, but you cannot offer incentives for that. So what I like to tell people is the best way to get a review is to think about how you create a reciprocal relationship with the buyer. Creating a reciprocal relationship, the easiest way to describe this is you're walking into a building, somebody holds the door open for you, there's another set of doors, you stop and you're going to hold the door open for them. When somebody does something kind and generous for you, you have a greater aptitude to want to do that back for them. And so that's what the relationship you're trying to create with your buyer. That starts with your product listing, your description, your enhanced brand content. It moves to your packaging, any product inserts that you have, and then it's completed with the request to write a review. You could offer a little bit more. Maybe you give them an extra ebook or something that they weren't expecting that helps them understand how to use the product better. But when somebody feels like they have an emotional connection to you, they have a greater desire to want to help you out. What I like to tell people is that you do business with people you like, then you do business with customers you like, with companies that you like, then finally you do businesses with products that you like. So if they like you, they will do it to help you out. And that's the relationship you're trying to create by giving them what they expected, giving them more than they expect, and then asking them in a kind way to do something for you.
You had mentioned product listing a minute ago. You know, it goes all the way through product listing and things like that. So is there something special or something that is maybe underutilized in a product listing that can help build that emotional connection or to be more helpful to make some sort of connection with the buyer?
Yeah. So one is on Amazon, they have a thing called Q&A. And if any of your customers ask questions, anybody who's ever bought your product before can give an answer. But you as the brand should also be giving an answer to all of your Q&A. You should also be using your Q&A to improve your product listing. And then again, with reviews, when people leave you reviews, you should comment back on them. I've had negative reviews changed because somebody has left me a negative review. I've commented on the review and said, I'm really sorry that that happened to you. Please open up a ticket and send me that product back. I'd be happy to issue you a refund and get you a new product. They do that. I then provide them the refund. I then provide them a new product. And then they come back and they update the review and they go, I had problems with this product, but the customer service I got from this company was amazing. They sent me a new product. The new product was fine. And if you have a good product and you provide good customer support, you should be getting good reviews. What I like to tell people is that if you have a bad product, you cannot make good reviews show up for a bad product without violating terms of service. bad products get bad reviews. There's one other thing that sellers should take advantage of. Amazon has a program called the Early Reviewer Program. It costs $60 per ASIN. You only pay that if you actually generate a review. Amazon, in that instance, will actually pay your customers to write reviews for you. They issue them like a $3 credit or something like that on the Amazon platform. But Amazon is soliciting that, and those are all considered legal. And there's no reason why when launching a new product, you shouldn't spend that money, because if you get those reviews, those are all helping to build towards the 5 to 10 that you need to really get your product going.
Do you think that program, do you think it's more beneficial to newer sellers or newer product launches? Or do you think pretty much anyone, regardless if they're an established seller with tons of reviews, do you think it's still valuable for them? Or is that more geared toward newer sellers on the platform?
So it's geared towards new products. I wouldn't say new sellers. Okay. I'll say it's geared towards new products. If you have over, I don't remember the exact number. If you have over, I think like 15 reviews on a product, you can't do the early reviewer program. So it is clearly designed for that initial launch of your program, of your product, to get the initial reviews that you need.
All right. So that whole goal is to do exactly what you're talking about, right? I think they understand how critical that first set of reviews is as well, and they're trying to push that.
Yeah, that's Amazon just giving more credence to the idea that your initial reviews are so important. The problem is that Amazon takes time to get those reviews. And so you doing something on your own to communicate with your buyers in a meaningful way that enhances the experience are things that will lead to a greater likelihood of more reviews.
You had mentioned two things in your previous answer that I think is worth repeating and reinforcing. So you mentioned good customer service, right? Good customer service is critical. And I think that's not an Amazon thing. That's just in general. I think in retail nowadays, I know it's especially more critical for me. So I like the fact that you said, be outward about your customer service, take care of the customer, and they'll appreciate you for it. The other thing that ties into that is responding to negative reviews or responding to good reviews as well, but making it public. You give the example of, you know, someone commented, said, hey, this wasn't good. And you were outward in your response saying, hey, open a ticket, send me this thing back, I'll get you a refund, I'll get you a new product. And they went back and they changed a review on you. So I think it's worth repeating that customer service is a differentiator for consumers nowadays, and making things public, which they always tell you in retail, on Twitter, if someone put something negative on there, you should respond to it in a positive manner, but make it public so people that might be analyzing your product or your company for the first time sees that, yes, I will be taken care of. So I just think it's worth mentioning. I think they were really good points that you brought up and examples there. How about underutilized or lesser thought about factors that go into collecting reviews? So you mentioned kind of completeness of the product profile and the product listing and having the Q&A and things like that on there. Are there underutilized tactics, and maybe get the Q&A is an underutilized tactic, or things that people think less about that would factor into collecting or aggregating more reviews?
Yeah, what I would say is that ultimately the process of soliciting reviews is the underutilized factor. If I had asked a question 2 years ago asking people if they were soliciting reviews for the products that they bought, 70% of the people in the room would raise their hand. Today, that's probably less than 50%. Sellers have become disenchanted with the idea of how to ask for reviews, or they saw it as a set it and forget it type of process, and they've completely ignored it in their business for some period of time. One, they maybe believe that they're not supposed to be asking their buyers for reviews, which Amazon clearly states in your policy that you can. Two, Amazon about a year ago started giving buyers the ability to opt out of messages from third-party sellers. And this caused quite a stir in the industry, primarily because sellers thought, oh, not as many of my messages are getting through. The value of doing this isn't there anymore. I'm going to stop doing it. But when the actual inverse is true, which is that less of your messages are getting through, and we can talk about why, but the ones that are getting through are that much more valuable. And if less people are sending messages and less messages are getting through, then your likelihood of getting a review is actually higher for the messages that you get through, because the consumer isn't inundated with as many messages as they were getting before. So Amazon sellers kind of create their own problem. That's the way I like to describe it. And so in the heyday of sending emails, we were sending 4, 5, 6 messages to a customer to ask them for a review, but we weren't providing any value. We were just asking them to write us a review. And Amazon didn't give those buyers any ability to opt out of those messages, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. Any website you sign up for, you have the ability to stop messages if you don't want to receive them. Amazon only added that functionality like a year ago. So now your messages are getting through to people who actually want to read those messages. Sellers are getting better at adding value to their message. They're enhancing the actual buyer experience. And therefore, the buyers who are reading it are more likely to actually leave a review. So that doesn't mean that the review rate is higher than it used to be. It just means that the value of those reviews that are coming through are worth that much more.
You had mentioned that the fewer companies, it's either set and forget or fewer companies are just sending them in general now. Do you have any theories about why that is? Have they just become complacent to accept things as they go?
Yeah, I think set it and forget it. A lot of times when I speak on stage and I remind people to go back and check their messages, it's just one of those things in their business that they just don't think about. Like, oh, I set that up a long time ago. I didn't really think that I needed to add anything to it. But if you own a website, you refresh your website every so often. If you have a house, you get it cleaned every so often. If you have messages going to your customer, you should be reviewing those. I recommend you review those once a quarter so that at least once a quarter, you're looking at what is the message that I'm sending to my buyers? What are the responses that I'm getting either from emails from my clients, Q&A, or reviews that are being left? And how can I use my email communication with my buyer to enhance the buyer experience?
I would agree with the quarterly checkup of any lifecycle message you have. If you are a retailer and send welcome series, post-purchase series, whatever it is, I would do that on a quarterly basis anyway. So I agree with your assessment there. You had mentioned that they used to send 5, 6, and then they've gotten better at providing value in the messages. I want to tackle both those things kind of independently because one of them is probably more arbitrary. But when we talk about providing value inside those messages to enhance the customer experience, are there certain things that you know to resonate well with consumers that you can put in those messages to add value to the messages? Or if not, what are some general ways that people can add value to the messages?
So ultimately, what I recommend is that you look at how does a consumer use your product and then what can you do to add value to that? So that comes from when you send the message. So if you sell a shampoo or a perfume or a makeup, you can't send that message on delivery because they haven't had time to actually use that product. If you're selling a toy or maybe a supplement or something like that, maybe you want to send a message immediately when the product is delivered to provide instructions of how to play the game, how alternative uses for the product that you have, instructions for taking the supplement that may be necessary. When you create that connection and you actually provide value in your message, that's when your consumer wants to come back and help you.
Very cool. And as far as number of messages, and this is something that's probably going to vary based on the retailer and, you know, different factors and things like that as well, products sold. How many messages do you think is probably appropriate? So you send the first one, you get no response from me because I deleted it or I just didn't have time to do it or I didn't want to do it. How many more should you realistically send me before you can be like, okay, Greg's just not reviewing this beer?
So if I look at the letter of the law with inside Amazon, they state you can send a message to your consumer asking for a product review. So we typically don't recommend you send more than one message. If you have a reason to send more than one message, you can do so. But this isn't like setting up a workflow on your own website that says, if this happens, do this. And if this happens, do that. You have to really put your value into your message. Amazon wants the messages to not be marketing, not be promotional, but be based on the product and the order that the consumer had. So if you are truly giving additional value and there's a reason to continue the conversation with your consumer, you can look at adding a second message. But this is where a lot of sellers try to skirt the rules. So again, use what you can, which is to send a message, provide the most value in that message. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. If you need to then follow up for some particular reason, then it could make sense to send a second message.
So let's shift away from email a little bit. Actual packaging. You buy something, I ship it out to you, and I put some sort of insert in there that asks for a review or something like that. What's the letter of the law as far as being able to include pieces of print material inside of the packaging, and then best way to kind of phrase that or make that most effective?
Yeah, so this is where it kind of gets a little tricky in the Amazon ecosystem. Package inserts are supposed to be related to the package and the product. Lots of sellers will still offer the, if you have a problem, contact customer support. If you'd like to leave a review, please consider, you know, going to Amazon and leaving a review. Just be very careful that it's not overly trying to market and promote people to come to your website, sign up for your newsletter, get an incentive to leave that review. You know, some people will some tactics sellers will use that are violations of the term and service. They'll say, sign up for our VIP discount club, you know, leave a review and get a free product or something like that. Those are the things you really want to stay away from, because there's two ways you're going to get caught. One, somebody returns your product and Amazon opens it up and sees the insert card. And two, your competitor will buy your product. They will see that you're doing something illegal on your insert card and they will actually turn you in. The insert card is an extension of the brand. Anchor does it, right? All the major brands on Amazon have insert cards. And again, if you're using language that is not subjective, right? If you're not saying like, if you had a negative experience, please contact our customer support. If it is positive, please leave us a review. What you want to say is, our customer support is here to help you. Please contact us if you need help. Others would love to hear your feedback on the product. Please write a review. Then you're going to be safe. It's the language that you're using that will get you in trouble, not the act of actually doing it.
Excellent. Good to know. And I'm sure you guys help with that as well. You guys help craft language and things like that for clients. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, we provide templates for our customers to use. Now, we highly recommend, and you'll see our templates are kind of like Mad Libs, where we have insert boxes for you to insert and customize the message to your buyer. What we found in our early days, in 2012, 2013, when we first got started, was that when we created a template message, everyone just used our templates. People wanted the easy button for getting this stuff done, but the easy button doesn't work. The messages that actually work are the messages that are crafted to your brand message, and to your consumer and your consumer's persona. And if you understand your consumer persona, who's buying your product, are they male? Are they female? How old are they? Do they have children? How much money do they make? If you craft that message in the same way you would craft a message on your website, then you're much more likely to get that person to connect with you and to leave a review.
Have you ever had a client, or maybe you receive these in general, but put a letter that looks like or is from the CEO? That's just like, oh, thanks for your product. You know, thanks for your purchase. We appreciate your business. So kind of taking a very personal approach and then having these soft, hey, if there's anything we could do for you from a customer service standpoint, let us know. Have you ever had a client or received one of these to be successful?
Yeah. So we always recommend that you actually sign things with a real name. People like to do business with other people. And if you try to get come off as like the, I'm a big company, people don't really like that. There used to be a tactic about 2 or 3 years ago where people would actually go out and say like, I'm a small business. Can you really help me out? You know, help a small business. I don't know that that tactic is really necessary today, but I do think you can say like, hi, I'm Jeff. I'm CEO of the company. I want to hear your feedback on my product. Please let me know what you think. That message has worked. If you're old like me, you remember the hair club days. Right, I'm not just a client. I'm also a consumer.
A customer, yeah.
I'm also a customer, right? People want that. They want to know that they're connecting with you. Now, I tend to tell people to also lean towards a female voice. It's just a little bit softer, but you know, that's just it's your brand, it's your message, and you should connect it and putting, maybe it's not your real CEO's name. You don't want people to look them up and come find them, but connecting it to a person inside your organization so they think they're speaking to somebody, not something, makes a big difference.
You know, that was a big tactic probably the last 2 years as well. Even from an email standpoint, a lot of retailers would send these, especially around the holiday time. They would just send an email that looked like it was from a CEO. Sometimes it might have been. You know what I always do? I always respond to those, though, because it's like, oh, it always comes from the CEO's email address or whoever's in charge there.
Right. Now, on Amazon, you can't control the email address, right? Because it's all going to come through Amazon's buyer-seller messaging system.
Sure.
But you can have it signed off by the CEO or by the owner or, you know, by the head of customer success or whatever titles you want to use.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say that I always respond to those emails and ask a question just to see if they just change the send from name or the address on there just to weed out stuff.
Right. You want to see if it's just an automated. Yeah. I've seen those too where people and it's like, oh, if you're interested, write me back and let me know. And I'm like, OK, am I really talking to the CEO? And we know from a marketing perspective, you're probably not. But it is that shocker every once in a while. You're like, well, wait, it was the CEO that wrote me back.
I have never gotten a response when I email a question back. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Oh, that's a bad marketing plan altogether, right?
That's right. You would think you'd have the intern monitoring those things or something. So, hey, I have a question about sites like FakeSpot, where they supposedly weed out fake reviews. Have you used those, and do you find them to be fairly accurate?
So first off, I would kind of say, like, who cares?
Do tell.
I guess as a consumer, do you care? I think that there are clearly patterns that can be seen that would indicate that a review or a group of reviews are fake. Amazon has created different processes to be able to weed these out. You now have to have an account and you have had to purchase a certain number of products. But you'll sometimes see if you dig in as a product owner, if you dig into your reviews, you might find that like a review was written by somebody, they've only written three reviews and all three were negative. And you think to yourself, well, those are fake. Well, then if you look at the text and the text was actually very similar between all three, maybe they are fake. The question is not what we as the product owners believe. It's what the consumer believes. And I do think there's probably a subset of consumers that have fake review or FakeSpot Chrome extension on their website and use that when evaluating reviews. But the truth of the matter is that I don't think most consumers do. I like to say the mom test, right? The mom test is where you have your mom go out and try to figure it out. And your mom isn't going to give a rat to whether that review is fake or not. She's probably not going to even understand the idea that there could be a fake review. Consumers ultimately are going to do one thing, and that is they're going to read the reviews. And the more complex the product is, the more reviews they're going to read. So let me give you an example. I was buying a TV stand that was going to be used at a trade show booth. And I knew I was going to put a 50-inch television on it. And so when I found my product on Amazon, I spent extra time reading the reviews because I was specifically looking for reviews where people talked about the size of the television and whether the television was tipping over or not based on it being too large. And when I read enough reviews that were explaining that the television wasn't tipping over, I believed what I was reading. Now, if I was going out and I was buying a new tennis bag, which I just bought for my son, a new tennis bag for his tennis racket, I didn't even really read the reviews. I looked at it. I looked at the pictures. I saw if it met what my needs were, and I bought the product primarily because I can get the product in. I can use the product, and if it doesn't work, I can return it. So when I needed to make a higher dollar purchase, I was much more inclined to dig into the reviews and do some more research. When I was kind of buying something quick and on the whim, my research for reviews just wasn't as deep.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. And I would probably agree with you that I think now that I think about it, I probably shop the same way. Although I will use, if there's something I'm torn between two products, even if it's something cheap, I always think of like electronics, right? I don't know, a car Bluetooth adapter or something.
Right.
I usually go to FakeSpot though, which is funny, but you're definitely right. For the higher ticket items, right? You're not going to get that TV unpacked and be like, oh, I need to return this thing now, repack it and deal with all that shipping on there. So yeah, that's probably about accurate. This has been really good information, Jeff, I think all the way through. And I love the examples you gave. What if I neglected to ask you that you feel is super important for listeners or retailers to know about when it comes to reviews on Amazon?
No, I think we covered it. It's not a very difficult topic. It's not a very in-depth topic. I think ultimately it's about just doing it. It's kind of like that simple. It's like one of the really easy things you can do to get reviews is to ask your customers when they buy to leave you a review. But with all the things you have going on in your e-commerce business, sometimes it's one of the easy things that you forget. And so it's not necessarily about what question you didn't ask me. It's about consumers taking the time to get it done. And if you have a large catalog, I understand that it can be very daunting to write customer messages for all of your product. Use the 80-20 rule. Find the products that are driving the majority of your sale. Write custom messages for those. Use a generic message for the rest of your products. Quite simply, there's no reason to not send a single message for each product that's being bought, providing your customers a good customer experience and asking them to write a review.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Jeff, you got a couple minutes to stick around and answer a couple fun questions?
Sure.
All right. What's the worst impulse purchase you've ever made on Amazon?
Wow. That's a good one. The worst impulse purchase I've ever made on Amazon. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was probably done using my mobile phone. I am a horrible purchaser. I know what it was. So for my kids go to camp and they like these lollipops called Linda's Lollies. And they like them because they're really big suckers. And like you take them to the campfire with you and they last like an hour. I actually made such a bad impulse purchase that I purchased two of them. So I ended up ordering my kids 200 lollipops. And because it was a food product, it wasn't returnable. So my kids were really happy that they got so many extra lollipops.
Do you still have lollipops in your house?
I do. I wouldn't give them more than the first 100. So I have the second 100 because based on the expiration date, they'll be good next year. So I just have them waiting in my closet for next year.
That's awesome. It's either that or you've got your holiday candy or your Halloween candy already purchased to dole out. Next question is a raging debate here on the podcast. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
So I live in Chicago. Oh, so yeah. I'm going to say that a hot dog is more than a sandwich. It's a meal, but you can't put ketchup on it.
Gene and Jude's, is that the best hot dog in Chicago or no?
So that's kind of a tough question. You know, pizza, I think I have a more strong opinion. Hot dogs seem to be on almost every corner. I don't know that I would go out of my way. It's kind of like the Chinese restaurant. Like everyone has their local Chinese restaurant that they like. That's the same with like a hot dog stand. Although if you want a very unique hot dog experience, there's a place in Chicago called the Wiener Circle. If you go there late at night, it's not safe for work, if you know what I mean.
Good to know. Good to know. How about a guilty pleasure? TV show, music, anything like that? What would your go-to guilty pleasure be?
Probably binge watching Homeland, or I just did the new Jack Ryan on Prime, Amazon Prime movies. I like to binge watch like kind of like those high action suspense drama shows. And I like to watch like the whole season at one time.
Okay. How old are your kids, if you don't mind me asking?
12, 11, and 7.
Okay. So this will somewhat be in your wheelhouse. Is Party in the USA a good song?
It's one that still lives on. It's one that still lives on, whether it's a good song or not. You know what was more scary than that was when I was recently at a family event and they said, okay, now we're going to play an oldie but a goodie. And they played Party in the USA. And I'm like, wait a minute. Party in the USA is now an oldie but a goodie? That was what scared me more than anything, because I think of like, you know, classic rock as oldies but goodies, not like Party in the USA.
A lot of Gen Zers at that party.
Yes.
How about Baby Shark?
I'm not familiar with Baby Shark.
Oh, man. I figured you had a seven-year-old. It's one of these kids' songs, but it is the most addicting thing. Don't listen to it because it'll be in your head for a year.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to listen to it, and I won't turn my child on to it.
Awesome. If you could have one meal for the rest of your life, what meal would you choose?
Chocolate cake.
That works. You a big chocolate fan?
I assume.
Or are you a big cake fan?
Yeah, it's kind of chocolate and whiskey are kind of my two secret obsessions.
Okay. So you're a chocolate fan. Three Musketeers, good or bad? Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Oh, I like a Three Musketeers. Yeah. I like a good nougat.
That's good. I like Three Musketeers, but a lot of people you talk to, they're like, that's gross. I'm like, really?
Yeah. I have a wide breadth of candy, chocolate, cookies that I like soft cookies. I like hard cookies. I like a Snickers, but I like a Three Musketeers.
All right. Very cool.
And I like a Kit Kat,
Oh, I love Kit Kats.
Yeah. My favorite, have you ever had the Milka Oreo? It's a German candy.
No.
And they have chunks of Oreo inside the chocolate.
Ooh, that sounds good. White chocolate, I assume?
Yeah, it's milk chocolate.
Oh, okay. No, I need to look that up. I'm sure I can order it on Amazon, so I'll be in good shape there.
Probably.
Jeff, any questions for me today?
No, I think we covered a lot of good stuff, and hopefully everybody has an opportunity to dig into this in their own business. I would welcome people to connect with me on LinkedIn, ask questions that they may have if I didn't cover something or wasn't clear about anything, and they're welcome to, you know, obviously check out our website and our products if that's something that they're interested in.
Awesome. And I was just going to ask you for contact info if someone wants to reach out. So you said on LinkedIn for you, you mentioned the website. It's going to be in the podcast description as well. But can you go ahead and give the website address as well?
Great. Let's go to sellerlabs.com/Bronto and we'll put a special offer up for any podcast listeners.
Awesome. All right, Jeff, thanks so much for your time today. And thanks everyone for listening, including the listener of the week, Danny from Atlanta. If you want to be the listener of the week, let me know you've tuned in. And if you're interested in telling your e-commerce story, I'd love to hear from you as well. I hope everyone enjoyed the episode. Until next time, have a great day and be kind to one another.